Welcome to the Kindle Chronicles, the Friday podcast all about your Kindle. I'm Len Edgerly, and this is episode 317 on Friday, August 29th, 2014. As you can tell, I'm down by the water at Ocean Park, Maine. Pretty good surf coming in at close to high tide at about 2 in the afternoon on Friday. So I'll hope to have this up for posting by this evening. If I get it up by 7 o'clock, Garrett Riley will be able to hear it driving up into the Sierras on the west coast. So that gives me a good deadline. It's a great beach day. Not much beach available for the umbrellas and all the colorful sights because the tide is coming in later in the day. There'll be quite an expanse of tidal flat that's revealed as the tide recedes. And pretty good waves for riding, but you don't get that long a ride at high tide. I'll give you a few more moments of the waves. Hope this is a soothing sound wherever you might be hearing it. And then we'll head up to the cottage and I'll tell you about today's show. Here at the cottage, I can see the ocean beyond the dune on this windy day, but you may have noticed that there was no thump-thump wind noise in my recording out there by the waves this time, and that's because a pretty cool little device I found at Amazon. It's a furry outdoor microphone windscreen muff made by Movo. It cost $9.99. It looks like bad white and gray hair of a troll, and I just slip it over the microphones of my Sony portable recorder to good effect out there when it's windy. My interview this week took place indoors here in Ocean Park, connected by Skype to the Open Road Media headquarters in New York City's fashionable Soho district. My guest is Julie Blatberg, who heads Open Road's innovative and persuasive engagement of book lovers through email newsletters and an arsenal of social media sites.
So Bill Gates read someone else's copy of the book a million years ago, and it made an impression. That's what social media is. The media part just amplifies it.
In news, I will introduce you to a site that I'd never heard of before Amazon announced that it was paying nearly $1 billion in cash to acquire this week. And from Maine, I will head west to follow a story in our hometown of Denver, where a high school class is starting the year replacing textbooks with 600 Kindle Fire HDs. For tech tips, I'm going to update you on the Clippings.io tool for usefully retrieving your Kindle annotations. And in content, we'll take a look at the big fall books coming our way soon. First up in news, I found it surprising that Amazon this week announced an acquisition costing nearly $1 billion in cash, and I had never even heard of the company. It's a three-year-old San Francisco startup named Twitch that Amazon is buying for $970 million. The deal is set to close by the end of the year. Twitch hosts videos about video gaming, and a lot of them. In July, it had more than 55 million visitors to its site who watched videos created by more than a million broadcasters. The Los Angeles Times, in reporting the story, quoted Amazon analysts who were mainly positive about the move, though they seemed a tad perplexed as to how this fits into Amazon's big picture. One said, "Within the great ecosystem war, gaming is critically important." Another, kind of a dissenter, asked, "Where's the tie-in to Amazon?" But even he stated, after admitting, "I don't really see it," that maybe they're acquiring something in order to dominate the sector in 5 years. I have dabbled in video games myself from time to time, especially when I bought the first generation Xbox years ago and played some Halo, but a visit to Twitch.tv this afternoon gave me a taste of how advanced the world of gaming has become. There is a multi-day international video gaming competition going on this weekend in Toronto called the Intel Extreme Masters. I tuned into a live stream of a game between two players wearing headphones, playing in what looked like sort of isolation booths or almost cages of some kind. And I was planning just to grab some quick audio to illustrate the story and then move on to prepare the rest of the episode. I couldn't tear myself away from it. I was just watching for about an hour as this video game matchup unfolded with a play-by-play commentary by two commentators. The combatants were playing StarCraft II: Heart of the Swarm, and the views switched from brief looks at the players to the audience in Toronto, but most of it was spent just looking at a map of the battle, which you'd see if you were, you know, actually playing the game. And there, fast-moving hordes of aliens and fighters were moving around, attacking each other and defending positions. And the commentators were a riot because they were using terms and language that were mainly meaningless to me, but had kind of a poetic tone to them. It was fascinating. I also found an eerie parallel with real battles from history and even current events in the Ukraine and the Middle East as these fictional video game armies went at each other, controlled by young men who I assume do this for a living. Here is an audio clip to give you a taste of the action at Twitch.
His economy is going to be too weak to continue, and Leonox is actually moving in.
Yeah. You know, I really like keeping the Marauders up front with the Thors, because the Thors will automatically target Mutalists to try to pick out the Marauders, and the Marauders simply aren't vulnerable to the Banelings, so he comes in once again. Now that it's time, there are a few Marines up here, but the majority of them still intact. He's pushing on this fourth base. He needs to be careful, though. He's stepping on creep, and there's still quite a few Banelings left, but I don't think Yoda cares as long as this fourth isn't mining.
Right, and he's actually evacuated the fourth. Basically, what Leonok is playing for now is he's giving up his current economy in order to play for a major battle as soon as his Ultralisks come out. He's going to use that to restabilize. And actually, Yoda overestimated the forces there. I don't know if he was attacking Larva or something, but the fourth does not go down, and Yoda's now coming back. We're going to watch this Ultralisk get closer to this fight.
I mean, Yoda's priority should be kill this hatchery and get the hell out, start cranking on it, maybe a few more Marauders. He sees the first Ultralisk, and it doesn't have all the upgrades it needs, so it dies very quickly.
Yeah, and at this point, it's
going to... Well, I hope you catch some of the feeling of that. And of course, it's a lot better with the actually having something to look at on the screen that makes a little bit more sense of what they're saying, but it's still pretty baffling and amazingly wonderful stuff. When news like this Twitch acquisition breaks, it makes me realize how little I really know about this company that's been the topic of my weekly podcast for 6 years at the Kindle Chronicles. I have a pretty good feel for the Kindle side of Amazon's business from a user and a reader's point of view, but compared with Twitch, Amazon Web Services, even the creation of new pilot TV shows, the Kindle operation sometimes seems quaint, kind of a Jane Austen drawing room in the midst of a very wild and fast-changing neighborhood. How this all fits together is beyond perhaps anyone's understanding except Jeff Bezos. The forward motion, innovation, and dizzying appetite for risk make it an intriguing beat. And even as I focus on the relatively small Kindle dimension of it, I like sort of looking outside the Kindle neighborhood or drawing room and seeing what's going on in the rest of the Amazon empire. It's the pace of it and the scale of it is pretty amazing. It's also, of course, another one of those amazing stories of here's a three-year-old San Francisco startup fetching nearly $1 billion in cash. My parents are staying next door here in Maine this week, and they're in their 80s, so at lunch today over at their cottage, I was trying to tell them about the Twitch story, and it felt as if I was just bringing them a science fiction tale that was actually reality. $1 billion for a company that lets you watch people play video games, I didn't really know where to begin explaining it. Next in news, listener Max Batson tipped me off to a story that he heard, I think he was in the car listening to the radio in Denver, our home base. A high school there has purchased 600 Kindle Fire HDs for its freshman class, and here's some of the story as it ran on Channel 7 News in Denver.
You know, the days of walking around with a heavy backpack full of books about to end here at South High School. All 500 freshmen getting one of these Kindle Fire HD tablets. The school here saying these will help better prepare students for college. Inside one of the oldest school buildings in Denver sits the most technologically advanced class in DPS. The class of 2018 is going all digital. tablets replacing textbooks.
I mean, I'm excited about it because you don't have to carry a bunch of stuff around, so that's cool.
This is one of the geometry classes.
South's tech guru, Josh Henn, came up with the idea.
We tried to think of reasons why we shouldn't do it, and we couldn't come up with a good one.
For every study that says children learn better on paper, school officials say they found one claiming digital learning is better.
I know that when kids walk out of our doors after they graduate from here and they go on to college, they're not going to have textbooks. Everything's going to be online. It's going to be digital. And if we aren't preparing them for that before they leave, we're doing them a disservice.
That last woman speaking was the principal at South High School. I'm thinking that when we're back in Denver after Christmas, I might have a chance to visit the school and see how that experiment is going. This story, no doubt, wouldn't have been as newsworthy if the students were using iPads, so I'm going to be interested to find out how this particular school opted for Kindle Fires instead. And finally in news, Goodreads has taken another interesting step integrating its social reading platform more closely with Amazon, which purchased Goodreads in 2013. Suzanne Scaivara, who is Global Communications Executive for Goodreads, announced in a blog post on August 25th that U.S. Goodreads members can now preview a Kindle book from within the Goodreads application when it's running on a computer. Now, this is not available yet on mobile devices or for Goodreads members outside the U.S. I suspect they're going to be working on getting it outside the U.S. as soon as possible. I tried this out by clicking on a listing for one of the books on my to-read shelf at Goodreads, The Crack Up by F. Scott Fitzgerald. The beginning of the book appeared when I clicked on preview in the Goodreads listing, and when I clicked on the Kindle icon, the sample opened up in the Kindle app that I have on my MacBook Air. And this enabled a two-column view for reading on my 11-inch screen of the computer. It's not that difficult to get to a sample of a Kindle book that you discover on Goodreads without this. You just click through to Amazon. It takes a few more clicks to get to the preview on the Amazon listing than is the case now, where you've just got one click on this new preview button. And one thing that we've learned about digital reading is that very small decreases in friction do add up to making the reading and buying experience significantly more convenient and pleasurable. So bravo to Otis Chandler and the Goodreads team for putting this one together. The tech tip I want to tell you about is to announce success in a joint project that I've been working with Jim Coverwell, who is the creator of the MyClippings.io annotations fetching tool for the Kindle. And what happened was, I have, since I annotate a lot when I read, I've been reading ever since 2007 when I got my first Kindle. It turns out I have 10,917 annotations on all the books that are in my Kindle archive. So when that amount of highlights and notes got cranked through the app, I was using the app as it existed as a Chrome extension on the Chrome browser. It took a couple of iterations for Jim working after his day job to get it to handle this huge amount of annotations that I was had to work with. And it finally happened, I think it about the night before last, the latest effort that he did after some tweaks that I didn't understand. He's obviously a pretty talented programmer on this, but he figured out a way for this all to happen. And so all it took, I think, 20 minutes to 30 minutes for all of my annotations to crank through the app. And as a result, then when I went and logged in at clippings.io, I had all the books of my archive there. I could pick a book and then I would see the annotations there. And I've got some more exploring to do, but one of the things which was very handy is I was able to take the annotations on a specific book and then export them to either a Word file or an Evernote note or a Kindle ebook that I could read on my Kindle. And I can see that when I work on book reviews, if I want to pull up all of the passages that I've highlighted, and there's an option where I can see what page numbers, if the book has page numbers, otherwise which locations, and then I can see all my notes. It's going to be a very convenient way to handle all this material compared with what I have to go through if I'm using Kindle.Amazon.com, which is the existing place where all of our annotations are hosted by Amazon. So this is, I can attest from personal experience that Jim has done a great job getting this thing debugged to where it can handle a really large amount of annotations. To get the full featured aspect of it, it's $1.99 a month. And I think that if you're going to be using your annotations a lot, especially for school or research or something, it's something that you might well want to take a look at. Julie Blatberg had been with HarperCollins, one of the big five publishers, on and off for 17 years before she became executive director for consumer engagement at Open Road Media last October. I reached her by Skype at Open Road Media's headquarters in Soho in New York City on August 22, 2014, and I began by asking her how her switch to Open Road came about.
When I got a call from Open Road to come down and talk to them about making a switch, I was really excited. As you know, Jane Friedman, the CEO of Open Road, was formerly CEO of HarperCollins, so I actually knew her from when she was down there. And, you know, the idea of coming to a company that's got one foot in what we would call traditional publishing, in that Jane Friedman is this veteran book publishing genius, but it's also a startup and it's a digital technology focused book publisher. It just seemed really cool to me. It's about 5 years old now, and they had the benefit of having knowledge of what we call legacy publishing, but they weren't encumbered by some of the things that often get in the way: systems, processes, nerdy things like databases or metadata being out of date. It was like really coming to the best of both worlds.
In talking to Jane, that when I interviewed her, you had that sense that it was a pretty dramatic opportunity to just create a whole new publishing company that was designed to take advantage of these digital opportunities.
That's definitely right. And in a way, because it's a smaller company, Open Road is able to experiment in different ways that some of our larger friends in the book publishing industry can't really do. It's a very creative team, and I mean that from the marketing and editorial perspective, as well as how we use technology to either solve problems or gain scale in different directions. It's really cool.
Can you say how many employees Open Road has now, roughly? Is it like 50 people or 200 people, or how big is it?
It's just over 50.
Do you know what number employee you were when you came in the fall?
I was in the 40s, so the company has grown in the last 11 months.
You'll be looked back as one of the originals of 10 years from now.
Yeah, I hope so.
Well, when you came on as executive director of consumer engagement, what was the mission? Did Jane and others give you a pretty clear sense of your mission and what exactly they wanted you to accomplish?
It's really about what I've been doing for the last few years of my career, which is focusing on growing an engaged audience for books and authors. It's pretty straightforward. Different channels that we work in, obviously social media. Email marketing to me is also a social media channel. Not everybody will speak of it that way, but it really is. And in a way, adding some holistic practices among the various categories in which we publish. You know, we have several different marketing and editorial teams here, each focused in different areas, be it science fiction and fantasy or literary fiction or cooking and lifestyle. So having kind of a bigger picture view about what we're doing in different channels.
Well, and that's, I think, kind of a holy grail for a lot of publishers, is to have a sense of the brand. And I can see the advantages if you thought an Open Road book, whether it was sci-fi or other categories, was going to have certain qualities to it. Is that the kind of thing that you have in mind when you talk about holistic marketing?
In book publishing, the book publisher is typically not the brand. So when I think about brand, I'm really thinking about an author or a series or sometimes a genre.
I see.
Can be thought of as the brand. So yes, of course, we want people to make a connection with Open Road books. Oh, this is a book I really loved, and it was published by Open Road. Therefore, I bet I would like other books published by them. That would be wonderful. But more often than not, it's, oh, this is a book by James Salter, and he's a brilliant writer, or this is a thriller in this compelling classic series, therefore I want to read all the other books in the series.
You know, and I think one thing that's happening for Open Road among people like myself who are real enthusiasts for ebooks is I notice that Open Road was one of the first publishers to make books available on Kindle Unlimited, as an example. And, you know, I love it when Amazon can try something new like that. And to see Open Road show up as one of the first publishers, clearly none of the big five were there. It just makes me think, yeah, you go Open Road, you know, you're sort of on my side of experimenting right along with Amazon and in the way that I have come to really love to read.
Well, thank you for saying that. And I think that speaks a lot to the executive management team at Open Road. And this is more of a business concept than a consumer concept, maybe. But the executives here are very interested in experimenting with different things. And that's what the digital age is great for. You can try different things. You can measure them and see how they work.
Yeah, exactly.
If it works well, repeat it, scale it. If it doesn't work, change it.
Well, now you've got five email newsletters currently. I'd like to mention each of them, but have you got one that has been the most satisfying in terms of the success you've had engaging readers with a particular newsletter?
I would like to speak about two of them, if I may. One of them is the Open Road Reader, which is our general interest newsletter. It focuses a lot on literary fiction and classics, but we also include books, stories from authors, different things going on in the media from all genres. And we've recently added a tagline to that, which is curated for book nerds everywhere. And I think this little switch in the content and the focus is really serving us well in that it's not so serious as it has been in the past. We're including different kinds of content and making it feel a little bit more like a stream on Twitter or a stream on a Tumblr blog that you like. It's a different way of telling stories about books and authors, and that's doing really well.
I love that tagline. What if somebody didn't know, how would you describe what you're thinking of as a book nerd?
Well, may I put the question back to you then? If you read or heard the line curated for book nerds, what does that make you think of?
Well, immediately it makes me think that it's curated for me, because I consider myself a book nerd and I guess proud of it. But I think, and the reason I would make that connection was just it seems to imply somebody who really loves books and who is maybe a little obsessive about it, or certainly pretty informed about what's going on with books.
That is so perfect. And in our market research that we just held 1 second ago, I think it's a success. Who would sign up for a newsletter that's all about books and authors but book nerds and people who really care deeply about books and book news and books from the past and books that are current? Book nerds.
Yeah. Where did you get the idea?
I guess because I'm a book nerd. So you look in the mirror and, you know, I'm thinking about the content, it's something I would read.
Yeah.
And I'm a reader, and I work with 50 plus people here at Open Road, and we're all book nerds too.
Yeah. Well, when the Open Road Reader began, was it more kind of serious and straight ahead? So this is quite a transition in positioning of it?
It's a subtle transition, I would say. We are also opening it up to be a newsletter that speaks to not only literary fiction, but other great books. And, you know, there are some people who will read 5 mysteries a month or 10 romance books each month, and they may not read a lot of other genres, but there are so many readers out there, like myself, who will pick up books from all different categories and may not be so attached to one. So we did want to break up the mix a little bit and have this really be a general interest newsletter. Though we also do offer newsletters for categories like mystery and romance.
Now, and you've got, as I remember it, there are top 5 links or something, and those were just sort of whimsical, different. How do you choose those links that you feature in each newsletter?
They are fun and whimsical, and again, these are the kinds of links that we would click on, either in Twitter or in a Facebook post or a Tumblr stream. They're really just entertaining. They're just little gifts for book nerds.
Can you give some examples of some fun ones you've had in recent issues?
There have been some beautiful art made either of books or from books. So we had a post to a wonderful photographer, Abelardo Morel. I've always been a fan of his work. And, you know, that's just an artist we thought people would enjoy seeing his work. Hmm. It's not about selling a book or trying to make anyone do anything. It's, here's some beautiful art you may not have seen, and if you're a book person, you'll probably really like this. We also had a link to an artist on Etsy who makes these sculptures out of books that are just really beautiful, and that one, that link was also very highly clicked.
You said that you wanted to talk about two newsletters. What's the other one you'd like to mention?
The other newsletter is one that we launched just about 4 weeks ago, and it's called Early Bird Books. And that is coming from this huge phenomenon in the book world, as I'm sure you and your listeners are well aware of. A lot of people like the ebook deals. Mm-hmm. So Early Bird Books is a daily newsletter with free and discounted ebooks of all different genres. And we're mailing it now 5 times a week, so every weekday. It's called Early Bird Books, so you get it first thing in the morning in your inbox. Mm-hmm. And so far we've had books that are free or 99 cents, $1.99, $2.99. Again, all different genres. We have mystery, we have romance, we have nonfiction, biography, literary fiction, teen and YA. And the growth of that newsletter from a business perspective has been exponential. We're so excited about it. And if you haven't signed up for it yet, you can. You know I'm going to plug this.
Of course.
It's earlybirdbooks.com. Mm-hmm. It's a simple page. You can sign up. And it's really giving the readers what they want. It's also a great way to discover new authors and new series. And so far, all of the books we've offered have been available for your Kindle readers.
The deals on these books, it looks like they just last one day. Is that the case?
Some of them are one-day deals. Some of them are a little bit longer. It depends on the book.
Hmm. And they're all books that are published by Open Road?
At this time, yes.
Is the pattern pretty much two books at discounted prices and one free? Like, I think the one this morning was a Sherlock Holmes collection that was for free.
That's right. It depends. We have done as many as 5 different books in a single mailing. And since this list is really so new, it's a great opportunity for us to experiment and see what kinds of books people are interested in. And I expect over time, we'll probably have more than 3 books a day. It'll probably be more like 5, if not more.
Can you go to a website for earlybirdbooks.com and find the day's things if for some reason you don't want to receive an email every day?
At this time, the only way to find out about the deals would be to either subscribe to the newsletter or connect with Early Bird Books on Twitter or Facebook. That said, Early Bird Books has only been launched about a month ago, and we are going to expand the content that we have on the website over time.
I see.
But again, now the way to get the deals is to connect with us in social or subscribe to the newsletter yourself.
Back to the Open Road reader, are you mentioning books sometimes that aren't published by Open Road, or is that, again, a way to showcase your own books?
Primarily, we are showcasing our own books and authors, but we will give a shout out to other authors in the industry when it's appropriate, when people are doing cool things. And next week's Open Road Reader does include a few different authors who are doing great work for culture, for society. In our social media channels, Open Road is more likely to connect with and shout out for other authors and publishers' works in the way that social media is just great for being authentic participants in the conversation about books.
Exactly, yeah. That's just a place where it's more like having a discussion at a coffee shop as opposed to a corporate communication.
Exactly.
Let's mention the others. You've got a mystery and thriller bulletin, and then what are the other newsletters you're sending out regularly?
We also have a romance newsletter, and we have Open Road Media Young Readers, which is not really meant to be read by children, teens, and tweens. It's really meant more for parents, for teachers, for librarians, for people who are interested in what's going on in the world of children's book publishing.
And then a cooking and craft newsletter?
That one is another offering we have, and I will say that having started to rebrand and relaunch some of our newsletters, if we have this conversation again next year, we're likely to be talking about a lot of different topics when it comes to our niche newsletters.
Well, now with these great newsletters, you must have thousands of subscribers, and what can you tell me about the growth or just the scale of the connection you're making with people through the newsletters?
As the executive director of consumer engagement, I'll tell you I'm very happy with our growth, especially in recent weeks and months. It's amazing to see. We're getting thousands, literally thousands of new subscribers each month, and the growth rate has been exponential. So I'm very pleased with that.
That's great. Well, let's turn to what probably most people tend to think of as social media, specifically Twitter and Facebook. Are you more active on one of those platforms than the other, or what's the presence there compared with these email newsletters?
It's also a big focus for us, as you can imagine. I would throw into that mix, we're also active on Tumblr, which obviously is just another opportunity, a slightly different audience demographic. We are also active on Google+, and there are different reasons for that. You can argue that YouTube is a social media platform, and we certainly have all of our videos on YouTube, and we have more than a million video views from our YouTube channel, and I think that's pretty impressive. But video is also part of the core of Open Road and how we present our authors to readers. There's also Goodreads, social platform in a way. It's both a community and a social network. So yes to all.
Which one do you spend the most time on a given day or a week?
I would say it depends on the day or the week, but it also kind of depends on the hour and the minute. You know, different books, different authors, different stories will likely work better in different social platforms. One example, a book that you and I had spoken about, Business Adventures. Clearly, it's a business book.
Yeah, now tell the story of that. That must have just really made life interesting for you for a while. How did that book become so widely known so quickly?
Bill Gates happens to be a big fan of the book Business Adventures by an author called John Brooks, who is deceased for a few years now. The book itself has been out of print for 40 plus years, but the author's son wanted to bring it back to life, and he had a relationship with Bill Gates, and Open Road was contacted, and Open Road published this book as an ebook, and also we do have some print copies out in the market. Bill Gates, being the big fan, helped with the launch in that he wrote a blog post about it, and that just set the world on fire in a good way for us and for the book. It became a bestseller. It was blogged about. It was written about by every business writer and every business journal. But when it came to social media, to go back to, well, if we're active in all these channels, what do you do on the case-by-case basis? You make decisions about, well, where shall we talk about Business Adventures? So LinkedIn would be a right choice for a book like this, more so than a Tumblr.
Because it's more sort of associated with uses in business.
Exactly. And Tumblr, we know the demographics are skewing much younger. They're teens, tweens, 20, 30-somethings. They're interested in different genres. So for the marketing team here, it's also thinking about where's the audience for a book like this, and where's the potential audience for a book like this. And in a way, that goes back to, well, who put the social in social media? That's one human being making a connection with another human being. So Bill Gates read someone else's copy of the book a million years ago, and it made an impression. That's what social media is. The media part just amplifies it, puts it in front of an audience that didn't see it 5 minutes ago.
Yeah, for it to really have impact, there has to be that sort of spark of a human connection.
And then exactly.
The rest is just tools to amplify it, I guess. Well, now, on Twitter followers, I looked up number of followers for Simon & Schuster, you, and the other big publishers, and it looked like Simon & Schuster has the most followers with 378,000, HarperCollins 138,000, and then you're in third place with 20,000 followers, Hachette 20, Penguin Random House, not much. How important are those raw numbers of the number of people that follow a player like Open Road versus other ways to sort of measure who's using the platform most effectively for their business?
I love this question. I always say it's not the size of your audience, but it's the level of engagement with your audience. And in fact, I wrote an op-ed about this a few years ago for Publishers Weekly, because it really bugs me when people just look at raw numbers and they say, oh, so-and-so has this many and so-and-so has that many. You can have a million followers, but if they don't click on your links and if they don't reply and if they don't retweet or comment, they're not really doing anything. They're not really valuable. So I'm always looking for, how engaged is this crowd? Are there retweets? Are there clicks? Are there likes when it comes to Twitter? For blog channels and for Facebook, are people commenting and sharing with their own audiences? That kind of endorsement is much more valuable than a million followers who are disengaged.
Mm.
Who maybe followed you 10 years ago when Twitter was a newer animal and people didn't know what it was. But if the engagement at the user level has dropped off, it's not really helping anybody.
How does that perspective on it guide you in what to put on Twitter?
It's very instinctual when you're living in it. And it's not a one-way conversation. So people who are successful in Twitter are those who are following other people who they like or brands for reasons that are personal or professional. And there's a rhythm, there's a language, there's a beat, and you get your voice, and then it's all very natural, isn't it? When it's done well.
Yeah. It takes a work to get to that place where it seems really natural. Well, if somebody said that you had to decide between newsletters or the social media platforms that we've talked about, and you had to get rid of one of them, there was some kind of budget cut or just some draconian decision that you had to choose which was the best way to engage with Open Road customers, what would you choose to keep and what would you let go?
This is like a Sophie's choice for a digital marketer. The only way I could answer that would be you really need both. You're speaking to different audiences in different times, at different points in their cycle, and you're speaking in a different voice.
Mm-hmm.
They're very different. And I think some businesses, not necessarily book publishing, but some businesses have moved away from email communications with their customers, and I think that's a big mistake. However, in any business, you need to be where your people are, and if readers of books are interested in emails from people talking about books and authors, and if they're on Twitter, and if they're on Tumblr, and if they're on LinkedIn, then you need to be everywhere where they are.
Do you think that it's easier to engage consumers of Open Road because the profile puts such a priority on digital versus print books, that somehow people who have made the shift to digital books are more available for engagement than people who are still reading traditionally on print?
You know, that's a good question, and I don't know if anyone has ever done any serious surveying around that. I'm sure that, I don't know how to answer that.
Yeah.
It's no easier and no harder. It's still talking about books, and books are stories, and There are a lot of people who are using devices that are active and social and love the idea that they can share their favorite lines from their ebooks direct to their social channels. And we're connecting with them online. And there are probably some people who are watching and not participating, mm-hmm. but I'm not really sure.
Yeah, and it might be hard to answer too, because for people that love a book, that's the primary fact as opposed to how they read it on paper versus digital. Mm-hmm. And if they've got that love of a book, that's what probably makes them ready to be engaged if you can find the right way to reach them.
Mm-hmm. And I think more and more, you know, as the age of digital is not so new anymore, in a way, well, who's not active in social media? And again, by social media, I am including email marketing in that category. Mm-hmm. My mother, for example, is not someone who is on Facebook or Twitter, but she loves her emails, and she was very proud to tell me that she subscribed to Early Bird Books last week.
Yeah, that's a good example. How about this summer for your reading? Has there been a book that you've recommended to friends and family more than any others that you've read this summer?
Good question. So, again, my answer is going to be two. For my book club, I read Where'd You Go, Bernadette by Maria Semple, mm-hmm. and it was fantastic. Mm-hmm. Loved it. And for the Open Road Book Club, we are talking about The Color Purple by Alice Walker, which we do publish in ebook. So I'm rereading that, and it's just incredible.
I have been speaking with Julie Blatberg, Executive Director of Consumer Engagement at Open Road Media. Thanks very much, Julie.
Thank you, Len. It's my pleasure.
In content, I will have a link at thekindlechronicles.com, the show notes page, to the big fall books chosen by Amazon's book editors, led by Sarah Nelson, who will be my guest on next week's show. Her team of book ninjas considered hundreds of books due out this fall in order to highlight a top 20 blockbusters and promising titles in the categories of biographies, comics and graphic novels, cookbooks, fiction, mysteries, nonfiction, romance, and science fiction, plus upcoming releases for kids and young adults. One section I particularly like offers the individual editors a chance to talk about their personal favorites from the fall list. For example, editor Neil Thompson chose a novel titled The Remedy for Love by Bill Rohrbach, scheduled for release on October 14th. Thompson's description is as follows. Bill Rohrbach, author of Life Among Giants, starts with an enticing premise. Two wounded souls are stuck in a cabin deep in the Maine woods during a snowstorm. From there, he weaves a thrilling, funny, romantic story about the entwined and volatile chemistries of fear, truth, and love. I noticed a blurb for Rohrbach's novel from Peter Heller, who's an outstanding writer I met at Booktopia Boulder and whose opinion I put a lot of weight in. He writes, "The remedy for love is not the remedy for sleep deprivation. You'll stay up all night. It is relentless and brilliant. Leave it to Rohrbach to tease out the subtlest nuances in the progress of love while stoking a tale that is as gripping as any Everest expedition, and that is also tender and terrifying and funny, and in the end, so true it seems inevitable. I'm not sure there's another American writing today who can lay down a love story or any story with the depth and appeal and freshness of Bill Rohrbach." It's clear that a lot of work went into preparing the 192 books that appear in various categories in this big fall books preview, and I'm looking forward to talking with Sarah Nelson next week to learn more about the process of choosing them and some more examples of what's on the list. That's it for this week. It's approaching 10 p.m. here on the East Coast, so my friend and eBooks for Troops assistant Garrett Riley and his family still have a couple of hours left, I think, on their five-hour drive up the Eastern Sierra Highway to Mammoth, California. Maybe they'll have a chance to listen to the show as they approach their destination. And wherever you are listening to my podcast, this is Len Edgerly in Ocean Park, Maine, saying I appreciate your taking the time to listen in. I'll close with a song that I listened to decades ago, wondering if I would ever reach the age that's mentioned, and tomorrow I will, August 30th.
Send me a postcard, drop me a line, stating point of view.